Ambassador Martin Indyk has honored us with his presence.
Thank you.
I, Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. The you were saying you were Assistant Secretary of State at that point. You're right in the middle of this story, and yet you also are able to establish a kind of a distance. And one of the things I admired was here is a gentleman who comes from Australia. So you're of us, but not of us. You're of us, but not from us. How does that go? And you're deeply committed to helping us help ourselves and help the world. Where does that come from?
Well, I'm an American. I mean, I chose to be an American. But I think growing up in Australia, I had a different, not just a different accent, but a different perspective. Because Australia was this kind of outpost of the Western world in an Asian sea, and exists in a kind of strategic environment.
And it's a direct product of colonialism.
Indeed. So I had, a distance, a different perspective on America's role in the world. I greatly admired America's role in the world. That's why I came here. I migrated here. I chose to be an American. I wanted to be part of that, to try to influence in a positive way what happens in the Middle East. But I think that I had a slightly different perspective. The book itself, I didn't want it to be a biography. In effect, I was not the central player there. It was Bill Clinton and all the other actors in the Middle East and the secretaries of state and so on. But I was in the room. I was, you know, working it. I was developing the ideas of policy. And so I had a front row seat. And I tried to write it in that way, as kind of being in many ways the fly on the wall, but also in some ways participating in trying to make things happen.
When you were in graduate school, you had a portrait on your door, which I think is part of this equation.
Mm-hmm.
Who was it that had this honored position, and why did they have that position?
Anwar Sadat. I was greatly impressed with his statesmanship. I had started this, my personal quest to help make peace in the Middle East, back in 1973, when the Yom Kippur War broke out. I was in Jerusalem. And Anwar Sadat was responsible for launching that surprise attack on Israel. And yet, I was already very interested in international relations, and I was very much aware that he had tried, before making war, he had tried to make peace. He had sent these messages to Israel publicly that he wanted to make peace. And then he increasingly expressed his frustration that he wasn't getting any response. And so I really felt, when the war broke out, that this was an unnecessary war. And I wrote an angry letter to Golda Meir, who was prime minister at the time, who designed it. I was just a student. But I was just so upset about it, that here was a war that didn't need to take place if she had been willing to take Sadat seriously. And then, I mean, as it went on, he then, you know, he turned, stopped the war as soon as Henry Kissinger engaged and negotiated a ceasefire, and then it became very clear that he wanted to make peace. He wanted to use the war as a platform for making peace. And he worked on that with Kissinger, and they had the disengagement agreements. Then Jimmy Carter comes along, determined to make peace. But again, the naivete kicks in. And he goes running after the Syrians because he wants to have a comprehensive solution. And Sadat wants to make peace. He's not going to let the Syrians veto it. And he stands up one day and says, I'm ready to go to the ends of the earth. I'm ready to go to Jerusalem to make peace. And it was in many ways an impatience with Carter, a desire to divert the United States from that effort to the effort that he cared about, which was to make the deal with Menachem Begin, and they'd had some secret negotiations. And, you know, and Carter swung around to his credit, and there wouldn't have been a peace treaty without Jimmy Carter there. But so for me, watching all of this from my perch as a student, a PhD student, and then as an academic, it was Sadat that was the man who drove the process of peace from its early days after the 73 war.
This,
and it was that statesmanship
yep.
that is so missing in the Middle East, and yet unexpectedly it will emerge from one or other of the leaders. Sadat, a Rabin, will come along, a King Hussein, and at those moments, we can actually make peace.
And Assad, in his own way, and if we don't recognize those moments...
Right.
There is... Years ago, somebody made a comment. I was at an event, and it was during the Bush years. It said, you know, this was bordering on an argument that, of course, this country was founded on the church and a religious perspective and something and something. And I said, I don't think so, but, you know, I went back and checked the Constitution, read a little more history, you know, scratched. And basically, this country was founded in the Enlightenment. Its history, its logic, the people who, the so-called founding fathers, were all deeply influenced by the English Enlightenment, not much less than the Continental Enlightenment. But, there, you know, we talk about naivete, and that there's a lot of that going on, but there's also a fundamentally different worldview, that if your founding mythology is predicated on the Enlightenment, which looks to reason, which looks to logic, which gets us to this we can solve anything mindset, because it's essentially, unfortunately, it's the Newtonian clockwork universe.
Mm-hmm.
And all you got to do is take apart the pieces and reassemble the pieces and live happily ever after. And I say that as you're talking about these bursts of opportunity. It seems as if, and this really is a question, it seems as if we go in with the idea that we can take the clock apart and reassemble the clock and we'll all live happily ever after. When in fact you're dealing with rich cultural, non-rational or extra-rational. That's not to say these people are any more irrational than we are. Some of the stories you tell suggest that, you know, we've got a long way to go ourselves in that area. Mm-hmm. But that if we are not flexible, if we're not adaptive, if we're not listening, if we don't have a sense of the history, and if we also are not flexible and willing to change our directions, willing to change our goals, then, and this matters because we're, you know, it's still broken, and in some ways more broken even than the period you're talking about. Fix it is not the right word, but we do have to live with it.
Yeah, but you see, you said it better than I could say it. I think that's exactly the nature of the encounter between the United States and the Middle East is fraught for precisely the reasons that you've explained here. Our different histories, a different culture, and they have a very deep and rich history. But their politics are different to ours, and their, as you say, their way of thinking is different. Now, Israel is a kind of exception. Israel,
which is part of the problem, probably.
Mold. And it's interesting you talked about the Newtonian clock. Ehud Barak, when he was Prime Minister of Israel, was very much focused on the clockwork. He actually, as a hobby, dismantled and reassembled clocks. Seriously, and the timing was everything to him. And he committed the same error. He operated on the same false assumption. You know, Osama bin Laden is credited with the saying. I don't know whether he said it, but it's a good line. It captures it. He said, "You Americans have the watches, but we have the time." And that's the critical difference. Time moves a lot more slowly in that part of the world. You got leaders there, authoritarian leaders, who have no term limits except the term of their natural lives. And they're not in a hurry by nature. We are in a hurry. We're a society that's in a terrible hurry. That's how come we invented fast food. You know?
And it's terrible.
Right, it's quintessentially American.
Yeah.
Right? We want change. We want it to come quickly and we're impatient. And they have all the patience in the world.
Well,
except there are those moments when suddenly these leaders feel that their throne is threatened, their people are restless, that they've got to do something. That's the moment when their clock speeds up. That's the moment when we can actually affect the change to a more peaceful, more democratic place.
And yet we've been tone deaf to that.
Exactly. We are tone deaf to it because, you know, it's very hard for us to accept that their clock is different.
Or that they might know something we don't know?
Indeed. But their experience is different. The way they react to things is different to the way we do. You know, it's one of the things that struck me as we were doing this. It's not just our innocence. There's also and an arrogance of assuming that they want to be like us. There's also an ignorance of their ways, of their history, and it's kind of willful on our part. You know, I had certainly studied the region, but when it came to actually making peace, when we had to, you know, for example, go to Camp David and try to write a peace treaty that would end the conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians, we weren't prepared for that. We hadn't done the study of it. We hadn't prepared all the research on Jerusalem, for instance. It was the first time we actually started to negotiate Jerusalem. And we were, you know, basically ignorant of all of the depths of these issues.
How can that be?
Why did we do that? You know, it's not as if we didn't have intelligence agencies and we didn't have capabilities or so on. I'm talking about myself here. But our team, we didn't do that kind of homework. And how can it be? Because, as you said, you know, we thought, well, hell, we'll just, you know, we'll come up with a solution. We thought we could, you know, the perfect example is we thought we could divide sovereignty in the holy sites in Jerusalem. Because, you know, here, the Temple Mount, where the ruins of the Jewish temple 2,000 years ago, are believed to be located, and therefore it is the holiest site in Judaism. Well, on top of that, it's called the Haram al-Sharif, is where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, third holiest place in Islam, right? They are, in effect, the same place.
And Jesus was born down the street.
And down the road, yeah. No, he wasn't. He was born
a few miles out.
But he was crucified there, or believed to have been crucified
And Gethsemane is there.
And buried there, you know. And so here you have in this little area a place of immense importance to people of faith all over the world, Jews, Muslims, and Christians. And we come in and we think, oh, okay, let's divide it. We'll give the Palestinian sovereignty on the surface and we'll give the Israeli sovereignty on the wall, and everybody will see that that's an obviously rational solution.
No. Ambassador Martin Indyk will tell us just how wrong we were when we return in just a moment with him, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. We hope you will be with us as well.